I'm from Grover Beach.
Hello, my name's Tom Dorst. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And, I was coming down here tonight, and there was a traffic jam between Willow Road and Seth. And I thought, wow, there sure is a lot of people going to that speaker meeting to see me. I announced this meeting this morning at the Village Group, my home group, and nobody was coming. So I told them that it was a speaker meeting. I was going to speak about my favorite topic, which is me. So that's what I'm going to do tonight. I'm going to talk about myself a lot. You're going to hear a lot about me, a lot about recovery, and a little bit about the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is March the 6th, 2012. As of 8 o'clock last night, I had 1,202 days of continuous sobriety. I have a home group. It's the Village Group in Oceano. A lot of sobriety in that room. I go there every day except for Thursday when I do something else for my recovery. There's a lot of old-timers in there that I always lean on and I talk to, and when I don't want to talk to them, they talk to me. They're always willing to grab you by the arm, and when you've shared something that they're not too sure what you've shared about, or they see you getting a little bit sideways with your program, they'll pull you aside and they'll get you squared away and straightened out. I have a sponsor. He's sitting down here. His name's Chris. He took me through the steps with the big book, one word at a time. It was an excruciating process, but I'm glad he did it. Before Chris, I had three other sponsors. The first one I got because everybody in the rooms kept telling me, you need a sponsor. So I've been told that I have a lousy sponsor picker. Fortunately, I've been with Chris a little over a year, and the first guy, I had him for about 3 weeks. We spoke once. The second time we talked, he called me on the phone and said he was drunk. So I told him what he tells me. He told me when I got him as a sponsor, asked me my sponsor, I said, call me back when you're done. Second guy was a really nice guy, Michael Jordan. You guys might know him, Michael J. I met him at the Orchid Lion's Den, and we worked together through the fourth step. And then his life got busy. And I understand completely how that can happen. He was newly married. He just bought a house. I was anxious to get through the steps, so I actually did my fourth step with another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after I did that fourth step with him, I asked him to be my sponsor and thanked Michael, and we've parted ways. I saw Michael a couple weeks ago up at the Serenity Group on Nelson Street, and he's a great guy. He's still sober, and I think a lot of him. He did a lot for my early sobriety without even knowing it. The third guy was a guy that had about 6 weeks of sobriety ahead of me, and we decided that we'd work together, and we worked together for about 7 or 8 months, and we decided that we'd rather be friends and remain friends than have a sponsor-sponsor relationship. So on my second sober birthday, I asked Chris to be my sponsor. He's been my sponsor ever since. Chris also has a sponsor, Frank Austin. I listened to Frank's CDs, and one of the things he says at the opening of it is, if you guys stop listening before I stop talking, that's okay. Another thing he says is that if you want to laugh at something I say, that's okay too, because a lot of the things that I did in drinking and now in sobriety, they're pretty damn funny even to me. I like to say that I'm a self-made alcoholic. Two great parents, they've since passed away. They were neither one of them alcoholic. I have four sisters, no brothers, no alcoholics. My parents each have siblings, and none of them are alcoholic. I have numerous cousins all over the country. None of them are alcoholic. I have one niece who's in the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who actually went to prison behind her disease, recently was released, and she's sober in the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and now does counseling for us to keep us sober. And she also has a sponsor and sponsees. What else? I took my first drink. Well, it wasn't actually, I didn't take it. There's a story in my family about when I was 3 years old, my three older sisters decided that they wanted to see what was in this bottle. It was a bottle that had L.A. Smog written on it. And what was in it was bourbon. and they took their 3-year-old brother, laid him on the floor, and tried to pour the bourbon in his mouth. Most of it went in my eyes, and I screamed and cried uncontrollably. And as you can imagine, when you have bourbon in your eyes, I've gotten it everywhere else. And anyways, I had 15 years of continuous sobriety after that first drink. Until I turned 18 and was at UCSB, and I discovered keg parties. And I also discovered that when I drink, to get drunk and get drunk, I'm better looking, smarter, I can talk to everybody about everything, and there's nothing I don't know. It's amazing what alcohol can do for me. So I went through my first year at Santa Barbara living in the dorms, drinking pretty much every day, drinking to get drunk, did a lot of outside issues. That was just part of the deal there where I lived, and continued that for 2 years. And went back to Los Angeles, where I grew up in San Fernando Valley, and tried to go to Northridge, drinking the whole time, and ended up not going, but you know, dropping out of school, and I was going to pursue a career in the grocery business, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Bonds, but that's where I was working. I started working there when I was 15 and a half years old as a boxman. I worked my way all the way up to journeyman clerk. What a career. So I worked there for, when I went back, for about a year, and you know, I started getting a little irritable and discontent and decided that it wasn't really a great place to live in the San Fernando Valley. And besides that, you know, my boss was getting pissed off at me because I was going to not come into work sometimes, and I'd call in sick, and I was working at night. And so my brother-in-law called me one day, and he says, there's this company up here in the Central Coast, a small grocery chain, and they're looking for some people. They build a lot of stores. They're expanding. They're growing. It's a great company to work for, small company. I know the guy who's the general manager. He works right under the owner. Why don't you come up here and interview for a job? So I did. I came up here and I interviewed. I stood in the parking lot at Main Street in the Williams Brothers parking lot, interviewed with a guy named Tom Hyland, who was the general manager for the company, and he hired me on the spot. He said, when can you be up here? I said, I'll have to give my 2 weeks' notice to Bonds. They didn't want my 2 weeks' notice, but that was the game I was playing with them. So I went back, gave my 2 weeks' notice. They said, you know, we don't need your 2 weeks' notice. So I had 2 weeks of unemployment in between the time I left Bonds to move up here to the Central Coast. I worked for Williams Brothers. I had, you know, limited success. I was still doing quite a bit of drinking, doing a lot of other stuff. And I met my wife working at the Williams Brothers down by what used to be Iverson Motors. And we got married, had a couple of kids, great kids, raised those kids. I, you know, started when I was working for Williams Brothers, they didn't have night crews when I came up here, which was nice. I worked during the day, which was cool. But after a while, they started running crews at night, and then I got put on the night crew and worked at night. And that's not great for family life. It's not great for anything. What it is good for is you have all day off to get drunk, all day off to smoke dope if you want, all day with your buddies, and everybody else is gone. Kids, you know, they were off at the babysitter. Wife was off at her job. I was in hog heaven. And that's what I am, a hog when it comes to drinking. I'm a pig. One drink is too much, and all the rest of them are just not enough. I'll drink until it's all gone, or I pass out. That's just my MO. So there I am. You know, I decide that Williams Brothers isn't good enough for me. I need to get an education, so I go back to school. Actually, my wife at the time, she was going to school, and I saw her taking these things called accounting classes. Looked pretty easy. Looked like something I could handle, something I could do. So I went back to Hancock, got my associate's degree, got my general education degree, and ended up at Cal Poly. Got my bachelor's science degree in business administration with a concentration in accounting, so I made it through. But I graduate, and here I am, 32 years old. The firms that hire people, the international and national firms, the big firms that pay the big bucks where you get the dough, they don't want somebody who's 32 years old. Everybody that works there is in their 20s. You know, I just, actually, one of the companies that I interviewed with, they were called the Big Eight back in those days. There was 8 national accounting firms. And I interviewed with one guy, and he was honest enough to say, you know, somebody of your age, you're going to be working for somebody who's 21, 22 years old, somebody fresh out of college, you know, a couple of years under their belt. So I don't care. I'm working for a guy who's 19 now. If he's got 2 more years of intelligence, you know, then great. I'm glad. I'll be happy to work there. Well, none of them hired me. So I went for about 6 months looking for a job, working at Williams Brothers, doing the night crew thing. Wow, it's just, you know, it's like a whirlwind, my life back in those days. I finally got hired by a local accounting firm. I got some help from some folks up at Cal Poly. Went to a dinner. I was supposed to work that night. I went to a dinner where they, like a round table dinner with the local CPA society, and met some folks. They asked me to come in for an interview, and they ended up hiring me. I couldn't believe they'd hired me. So I actually, when I gave my notice to Williams Brothers in October of 1987, they said, you know, can you stick around till the end of the year? Because, you know, October, then you got Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, big holiday times. And it didn't matter that, you know, I was probably a pretty good drunk and not really that reliable person, but they would need a body set. So I stuck around. I told the firm that I couldn't come to work until after the first of the year, so I had one day off. December 31st, I was off. On January 2nd, I went to work for an accounting firm, local accounting firm in Santa Maria. It was, you know, my first day on the job. They put me in an office. I went in with a tie and a suit. It was amazing. You know, I'd reached my pinnacle. I'd done everything I had to do. All I had to do was just sit there and be good, and I would be successful. It would just be handed to me. Yeah. So I'm working at this firm, and I go through my first tax season with them, and I was the math checker. I was the only math checker, which means that they would hand me their stuff, and I'd go through and make sure that the numbers added up. I was the arithmetician. All I did was just add up numbers all day long, 10 key, 10 key. In those days, there wasn't any TurboTax or any of that stuff. Everything we had to do was on input sheets, and then it was all shipped down to Los Angeles for a central processing unit, took care of it, and sent it back. It took a week to do the simplest of returns in the process that we used. And my job that first year was to go through, take all the pieces of paper that clients had brought in, match it up with the piece of paper that they had written it on, make sure that the numbers matched, that they put it. You know, it was really boring. You know, it didn't take a lot of brain power, but that's what they had me doing. So I went through, and, you know, I was not drinking a lot. You know, I was keeping my cool. I was being a good boy. And we got to the end of tax season, and the first tax season party was a nice little blowout. They took us down to, I think it was Maddie's Tavern down in Los Olivos, and that was where the first tax season party was. They bust us all down there. Grand time. And I got a new nickname after that first tax season party. It was Tequila Tom. I decided that it would be a good night to drink kamikazes, tequila kamikazes, and I was pounding them down, just throwing them back. We went down there, came back. I don't remember about half of that first tax season party. And that's how it was. That's how it was for me. In those years up to graduating from Cal Poly, I had intermittent periods of sobriety where I wouldn't drink. You know, I wasn't, you know, I was irritable and discontent. I'm still an alcoholic. I would not drink for months because it was just impossible to drink. I was going to work at night. I was going to Cal Poly during the day. I was trying to take care of my kids, you know, in the time between going to work, and, you know, it was just, you know, crazy. Anyways, I went through working for this firm, did another couple more tax seasons, and then I, you know, started getting those itchy feet. I don't want to stick around here. I'm not getting what I want. A little bit of selfishness creeping in, you know, so I decide that I need a change of career. I'm going to do a little lateral move. So I start applying for jobs at the County of Santa Barbara, I'm looking for controller jobs in the paper. This is before, you know, all the internet stuff where you could apply online and all that. Everything had to be done by paper. I went down to the county of Santa Barbara and took a test. Anyways, I just, itchy feet. I'm always looking for the next best thing in my life to get me over that hump, just to make me feel a little bit better. And when I don't find it, then you know, a few shots, you know, a few beers. You know, I just could never satisfy that thing in my head that kept me going. So finally, one of the partners decides that his wife is a controller in Guadalupe at a produce firm, and she asked me to come and be the assistant controller. Perfect. Getting out of the firm, going to work as an assistant controller. Life's going to improve. Everything's going to get better. I'm going to get my own car. Everything's going to get better. That's exactly what happened. Everything got way better. I went out there, started working, and same thing happened. I was, you know, getting drunk every night because I wasn't feeling like I was being used to my full extent. I had all this brain power, don't you know? I'm smarter than everybody else in the room, and I was getting drunk every night. I left out one part of the story. When I was working for that firm, I don't have, a very low bottom. I have a really high bottom. Wasn't ever arrested. I haven't been to rehab. I white-knuckled my recovery. But I did have one brush with the law. My firm, when I was first started working for them, they built a building over on McCoy, and we were moving from over on Chapel to McCoy, and it was my job, since I was the only guy with a pickup and the only guy, to load all the boxes of files up and take them over to the new office. So I'm doing that every day. You know, they don't have anything else for me to do, so I'm loading boxes and roping them off and taking them over there. So I'm driving back from dropping off my load one day, and I have a rope hanging out of my truck. Get over to Miller and Battles, and Alan Hancock, PD, hits the cherries and pulls me over. I pull over. Did you know you had a rope hanging out of your back of your truck? Yeah, I did. I'm going to have to call Santa Maria PD because I can't write you a ticket here. You have a mirror missing. You would have seen it, you know, all that. Yeah, no problem. So Santa Maria PD comes over. Can you show me your driver's license and registration? And I'm digging through the glove box, throwing everything in the glove box onto the seat. And so I give him the license and registration, and another cop's looking through the other side. You might have to look in your truck, and he grabs this little bag and he says, "What's this?" I said, "I don't know, it's not mine." "Of course it's not." That's what he said. So I got a ticket for having possession of an ounce or less. I went to court, ran into a guy that I know. He was there because he got a ticket for throwing some trash in a dumpster. My ticket was $125. His was $175. So I found out that it's cheaper to have pot than to throw trash in the dumpster. Anyways, that's a little bit of just a little background on me. So I go to work in Guadalupe, and you know, I'm still a little bit irritable and discontent, still trying to find that thing that's going to make me feel better. And so I'm working there, and then another opportunity comes up within this company. They have another place where they want me to go and try and work. And so I'm working at this other place, and it comes up that they need a controller at this other place. So they're going to hire somebody. And in my drunken stupor one night, sitting with a friend who knew my boss, drunk off my ass, I could do a better job than any son bitch in this, you know, that they could hire. They already had a guy picked up, so they just go ahead and let him run with it, give it to him. Well, it turns out that company was already on the skids, already on the way down, and I ended up riding it down, major depression, a lot more drinking, suicidal tendencies, thinking about suicide on my way to work. You know, when you're going down blocks of road and those big produce trucks are coming towards you, I'd see those lights, and I'd think, if I just pulled right out in front of that guy, he'd smash me, I'd die, and everybody'd be happy, and I'd be done. Never had the guts to do anything like that, but I sure thought about it a lot on my way to work. So what happens is I have this friend from the firm who we were partying with and hanging out with, and she just gets her license and she becomes certified, and she says, you know, you're really tired of working there, why don't you come work with me? So I think, yeah, great, another opportunity. I can go and work with her, and I can fulfill my destiny. I have a destiny now. So I still don't have my license. I've been working in the accounting profession for about 7 years. I still don't have my license. Several failed attempts at passing the exam. The first time I went to take the exam over in Fresno, I went and stayed in the hotel with a guy that I was going to school with. We just went there. They told us, just go see where the bathrooms are. You don't have to worry about passing the test. So we figured that was carte blanche just to get annihilated every night. So that's what we did. We'd sit in our room, watch TV, drink beer, get fucked up, and then go and sit in the hot, steamy room in Fresno and try and take the, you know, the hardest comprehensive examination on the planet. Lawyers will argue with that. I hope there's no lawyers in here. But it's been, there's more stuff that you have to remember for that exam, and 99% of it is useless information, but you remember it anyways. So I go to work with Kathy, and we get a little office, and we're doing the accounting thing, we're doing the tax season thing, we're doing some counting, some taxes, and some accounting, and so then I decide I'm going to try and pass this tough exam. So I buckle down. I'm going to go take this review course in Santa Barbara. And I go to Santa Barbara every Saturday for 4 months, and I sit through this 8-hour class to learn how to pass this examination. And every day, you know, all the time I'm drinking. I'm drinking, you know, 24/7, but I'm drinking pretty much every day all this time. Have been for a long time. Don't even realize what I'm doing most of the time. So I go and I sit through this review course, and I spend the summer going to Goleta every Saturday, sitting through this class, come back, take, you know, do my homework, because if you don't do your homework, you don't get to take it for free if you don't pass when you go. And this is 1998 by now. And so I'm studying for this exam. I'm thinking, I'm going to pass this thing. I'm really going to do it this time. I'm really going to pass. So it's 1998, October. October 8th of 1998, October 7th, I get a call from my sister. You need to come to Ventura. Dad's not doing so good. You need to come down here. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. I said, okay, I hop in the car. I drive down to Ventura. And my dad is in the hospital again. My dad's had two bypass surgeries. And he had a hernia surgery about a week before that. And I get down to Ventura Community Hospital. I go up to where my dad is in ICU, and he's laying there breathing his last, you know, barely hanging on to life. And this doctor walks into the room, leans over and shakes my dad's hand. Sorry, I might get choked up here, even though it's been a long time. He leans down and he says to my dad, my mom's there, and three of my sisters. And he says, boy, if I'd have known this was going to happen, I wouldn't have done the surgery. What happened was my dad had the surgery. He went home, outpatient, hernia surgery, and went into the bathroom, aspirated some of his own vomit, got pneumonia, and died in 24 hours. So here I am, an alcoholic, dead dad. Mom, sister's going crazy, people flying in from all over the country, aunts and uncles, and so I said, what do I decide to do? We get a hotel in Ventura, and let's get drunk. So I do. And this is 4 weeks before I'm supposed to sit for this extremely difficult examination. You know, it was really convenient. My dad died on a weekend that I didn't have a class, so I could go to this memorial service. And so I go through the, finish the class, you know, choking back my emotions, pushing things down like I do, and I managed to pass two parts of the CPA exam. So, cool, I got two parts. Go back in May and do the other two. I've got to do the same thing that I did all summer, is go to this review course every Saturday, trying to keep myself together and hold myself together. My mom's calling me. She's trying to figure out how she's going to get along without my dad, and figure out all her finances, and my dad's always done all that for her, and, you know, so I'm trying to help my mom, drinking, and going to Ventura, and talking to my mom, talking to my sisters. drinking more, and I try and take this, I go through and I take the review course, I pass the rest of the CPA exam. I made it. I finally have, I'm a professional now, certified by the state. Not quite. Now I have to go through the state hoops to get, you know, so that's more frustration, more hoops. Finally, after about a year, I finally get my license, and I'm practicing accounting in the state of California. I'm working in a cool little office. We're doing tax season. We're doing accounting. We're, you know, everything's going along. It's just, I'm a mover and a shaker now. I don't have to wear a tie anymore because I'm my own boss. Self-employed. And I always tell people when they come into my office and ask me about, I'm thinking of starting my own business. And I'm thinking this would be a really good thing for me. I always tell them, you know, there's a fine line when you have your own business between self and un. There's some days where you're self-employed, and that's when you're working. There's other days when you're unemployed, and you're not working. You're not making any money if nobody's sitting in the chair across from you. You're not making any money if you're not making phone calls. You're out there promoting yourself. That's the only way you make money. So I'm, you know, here I am sitting in my office drinking. Not in my office drinking, but I'm drinking when I get home, first thing. I can't wait till that 2 o'clock alarm goes off. I'm like Fred Flintstone going down the back of a brontosaurus. Yabba dabba do, let's get drunk. That's the only reason I drink. And so here I am. Got a nice little office over there on South Broadway. I got a new home, and, you know, I can walk to work. It's only a few blocks. Just a few blocks from my office, so I can walk and save all this money by walking. Problem of geography is there's this little bar right in between where my house is and my office, and it's amazing, but this place has a back door and a front door. So I walk in the back door, 6 o'clock in the morning, have a cup of coffee with the bartender. I'm not drinking yet, but I head out the front door and go to my office, do my thing, start feeling a little edgy about 11, eat my lunch. And then I think, you know, it's 12 o'clock. I think I'll go down there and I'll see who's hanging out down at the bar. So I march my little ass out of, you know, my bag over my shoulder, my sunglasses on, head down to the bar, and I go in and I plop my butt down in a chair. I'm just going to have one. I'll just have one and then I'll head out. You know, pretty soon another guy comes in, and then we're rolling dice for drinks, and we're having a great time. Everybody's slapping each other on the back, telling each other how great we are, and I'm drinking. Just pounding them down, spending all kinds of money that I don't have. So, you know, just that's how it went for me for a while. Pretty soon, my wife gets tired of me not being around, so she comes and she joins me. She sits down there with me at that bar. Wow. You know, I just, not only am I an alcoholic, now I'm turning everybody around me into alcoholics. You know, this is, it must be a learned behavior. Because, you know, I don't have anybody that I know to be alcoholic in my family. No blood relatives other than that one niece. But here I am, drinking with all the rest of the alcoholics. And we're happy. We're a happy bunch of guys. Yeah, rolling dice, going fishing in Mexico. Yeah, we had a great time. Several years of that, the wife joins me. You know, we're in the bars, and it's just, you know, happy days, you know. Then that, you know, place loses its lease, they have to move across town, that's no problem for me, I'll just go ahead and drive on over there. So the first thing I do is I hop in my car, drive over to where the new bar is, you know, and now I'm driving drunk, endangering you and all your families, putting everybody in the world at risk because I have no self-control. I cannot stop drinking. I just love the drink. I love the taste. I love the effect. I love everything about alcohol. It turns me into a perfect person. Brilliant. They trust me with their money. We have this pool. You know, football pools. You've seen those things. So we get this pool and everybody throws in, you know, $200 or $300. We get a pot of 10 grand. I got $10,000 of other people's money and they trust me with it. Drinking away, rolling dice, doing the whole thing. Yep. So, you know, so I'm trustworthy. Even in my drunkenness and my alcoholism, I'm still trustworthy. People still trust me with their money. And my clients, they're none the wiser because I don't talk about this stuff to them. But several of the people that are in this place, they're my clients also. and they know all about me, you know, but they're just like me. So I hang around with people who are just like me. They all drink like me, they act like me, they're just like me, and I'm good with that for now. And I'll go along a little longer, and, you know, pretty soon people are saying, you know, you don't look too drunk, and you drive me home. So I'm driving people home, going back to the bar, still, you know, endangering you and all your families, putting everybody at risk, including myself, without a care in the world. You know, I've had concussions and separated shoulders and everything else in my drunkenness. You know, go to a fundraiser and end up on the ground, go to a family reunion and play a volleyball game that I don't remember, get a concussion and forget the rest of the week. You know, I had a I had an amazing life going into this thing. Amazing. So, get to someplace around 2011, I guess, and I'm thinking I'm spending a lot of damn money at the bar. I'm spending a lot of money on alcohol. I'm getting drunk too much. I should probably try and control this thing. So I think I can do that. I can control this thing. I can control my drinking. So I just start drinking at home more, buying more alcohol, drinking at home more, not going to the bar as much. Maybe I won't go there on Saturday morning. Maybe I'll wait until 2 in the afternoon. Because my MO is on Saturday and Sunday, Saturday I would get up, I'd go out and wash my car, wash the wife's car, whichever car I decided to wash that day, and then I'd have to make a trip to Pep Boys. I'm going to Pep Boys. I'm going to pick up a few things, you know. I got things to do. I got important stuff, you know. Well, Pep Boys, my daughter didn't take her long to figure this out. Pep Boys was, you know, geography. Pep Boys was past the place that I used to go drink, so I'd go to Pep Boys. I'd pick up the armor all over the car wax, but on my way back, I'd stop at the bar. And there I was, Saturday morning, 9 o'clock, drinking with the fellas, starting out with Bloody Marys, graduating to screwdrivers, and I'm rum and, no rum, it's always vodka, it's just by this point, vodka and Coke, vodka and diet, vodka and anything sweet, vodka and vodka. A lot of that. And so that's, you know, that's my drinking. That's how I drank. And I'm not a very nice person sometimes when I get drunk. I have a, you might say, a barbed tongue. I was raised in the house with four girls, no brothers again. And we had a way of talking to each other that was, could be characterized as sarcastic. Yeah, that's what you'd call it, sarcastic. So, you know, somebody would say something to me and I'd come up with a quip. You know, I'm right off the top of my head, I had something to say about everything. Somebody will, you know, so pretty soon I'm denigrating all the people that I love. I'm treating them like shit. I'm, you know, I'm not a very nice person when I'm drinking, and if you try and stop me from drinking, I'm really not a very nice person. And, you know, you say something to me, and I might just fire back something at you. I might, you know, I don't even care if I hurt your feelings or not. I'm just a piece of shit, you know. And so I go along, and I'm happy sometimes, not so happy sometimes, and I'm, you know, I'm denigrating my wife, I'm fighting with my daughter, I'm controlling my daughter, I'm giving her stuff to control her more. Don't you know how much it's done for you? So my daughter moves out and takes my two granddaughters. And I was pissed off at the two people that gave her a place to live so she wouldn't have to live with me. Mad at those folks. They went to a church. I did a lot of research on the internet about this church, figured out that they were a cult. They were going to destroy my family, even though I'd already destroyed my family with my behavior and my alcoholism. I was killing it. You know, I helped my daughter move in there. I was pissed off. I didn't want to be around these people. I didn't want to know their names. They're the greatest people in the world. They were, you know, they took my daughter in when she had nowhere else to go, and they're just great people. I've gotten to know them since, and they're great people. I love them. Anyway, so they move out pretty soon. The wife had enough of me. She moves out. So there I am, all by myself. What am I gonna fucking do now? I'll have a drink. That'll make it better. So here I am, all alone, depressed, all by myself, you know. And, you know, so the wife says she wants to come back, so I decide that this would be a great time to stop drinking. So I tell her, there's two conditions for you to come back. First one is we have to stop drinking. That was a pretty good idea. Second one is we have to stop going to the bar that we drink at. Two really good ideas. I finally had a cogent thought. So she comes back, and we stop drinking, and I'm still too much for her. I'm still an asshole. I'm still denigrating. I'm still pejorative. I'm all the things that I was before, but the only thing is I don't have any liquor in me, so I don't mellow at any point. I just go straight from nice guy to fuck up an asshole. And that's where I go in sobriety. She had enough of that too. So she leaves again. She ends up going to her folks in Oregon. I hadn't had a drink. It's March 6th of 2012, my sobriety date. I haven't had a drink since that day. But here I am. What am I going to do now? I'm not drinking. I'm uncomfortable. What am I going to do? My daughter's gone. My grandkids are gone. My son, you know, he's on his own deal. What am I going to do? So I wake up in the middle of the night one night, and I am just, my hair is on fire. I'm insane. I'm not drinking. I'm uncomfortable. I'm alone. So I call up Cottage Hospital, and I ask, what do I do now? I'm crying like a baby. I'm tearing myself up. And this guy says, what in the hell is wrong with you? You should be taking care of yourself. Well, I don't know what to do. And so I'm talking to this guy on the phone. He says, well, I have one suggestion for you, and I don't know if you're going to take it or not. He says, there's this thing they have over at this church, and it's a 12-step program. I said, it's not AA, is it? No, it's not AA. So I decide that he tells me where it is, he tells me when it is, and I call my daughter up, and, you know, we've kind of reconciled by this point, because I'm not drinking, but I'm still insane. And so my daughter says, well, I'll go with you to this 12-step meeting. So I go over there, and that's the first place that I stood up in a public place, and I said my name, and I said, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And I started crying. And I sat down, and I put my hands in my face in my hands, and I just cried like a baby. That was, you know, I don't know what possessed me, what was going on with me at that point, that I just couldn't, my emotions just got the better of me. So about a week later, still alone, I wake up in the middle of the night, and I feel like something's over me. Somebody's in the house. There's nobody in the house, of course, except for me. But I wake up, I go downstairs into my kitchen, I'm standing there, and again I start to cry uncontrollably. And I stop after about 15 or 20 minutes, and thinking to myself, you know, I don't feel like I want to drink now. Huh, this is weird. This is really strange. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, I don't feel like I need a drink. The compulsion to drink had been lifted from me without me even knowing it, without me asking for it. Somebody was looking out for me. Somebody had my back. I don't know who it was, what it was at that point. All I knew is that I didn't want to drink. So I empty all the liquor out of the cabinets. I'm pouring it down the drain. I'm OCD, so now I'm rearranging all the cabinets in the kitchen. I got all the salts and all the things in the right sizes on the shelf, and I'm taking pictures. 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm texting these pictures to everybody that I know. Got several responses from several people around the country, people that I know. Wow, when are you coming to my house? You don't want me in your house. It's amazing, you get rid of the liquor, and you have so much more storage space. Very miracle. One of the gifts of sobriety. So I did the same thing in the trailer. We had a fifth wheel trailer. It was parked in the driveway. I cleaned all those cabinets out, dumped all the liquor out. I must have dumped out $10,000 worth of alcohol. all different kinds of tequilas, one in a blue bottle with a cork in it, never even been cracked. I wasn't going to give it to my kid, dumped it down the drain, you know, my house smelled like a frickin' brewery after all that. Crazy. So anyway, so I did that, got, you know, here I am, no alcohol. Pretty soon my daughter calls me up and she says, I have these friends, you know them, Chuck and Shelly, and they have this friend named Bud, and he goes to AA meetings. I said, okay, well, have him call me. So this guy, Bud, calls me up and he says, hey, you want to go to a meeting with me? Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and of course, I'm recoiling in shock and awe. And I said, sure, why not? So the place is, he says, just meet me at the airport. There's a meeting room, there's the main terminal of the meeting room. Just meet me over there and we'll talk before the meeting. I forget, I think the meeting's at 8 o'clock. Meet me there at 7:30 and I'll take you to the meeting and just see a few of the people and we'll see how it goes, okay? I said, sure, okay, I'll go. I'll try anything once. So I go to the meeting, and if you've been to the airport, you know where the meeting room is. It's over here. You know where the fire station is? Over here? I parked over there. I didn't want anybody to know that I was going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Who knew? So I park over here. I walk all the way across the terminal. I walk the long way over to the meeting. I meet Bud there, and Bud and I speak for a few minutes, and he takes me in there, and I hear a lot of stuff going on in that room, and one of the things that I heard in there that night was something that I didn't even recognize, something that somebody's pointed out to me at my home group in Oceano, is a guy named Barney up there, and he points out that, you know, that strange thing you're hearing in those rooms? Something called the truth. The truth you're hearing in there. It's why it's so strange to you, because you've been so estranged from it for so long. Yeah, I guess that's what it is. Yeah. I'm an alcoholic. I said it a couple weeks ago at that meeting over there. I've done my first step. I'm ready for the rest. So I go to the meeting with Bud, and after the meeting, me and Bud speak outside, and I see Bud knows a lot of folks in there. He's got a lot of friends in this room. And Bud says, you want to go to another meeting on Thursday? I said, sure, okay. That was not bad. I actually came out of there unscathed, no scars. So Bud says, well, meet me over here at College and Battles at this church, and we're going to go to a men's stag there. It's a really good meeting, too. It's like, okay. So I go over to the meeting at the men's, I go to the men's stag. And after the meeting, you know, I meet a few more guys, and it seems pretty cool. And Bud walks up and says, do you have a big book? I said, no, don't have a big book. Got a Bible, but no big book. So Bud hands me this book. He says, read the first 164 pages. I said, okay. So, and you know, I've heard somebody share at this meeting over at the airport about, you know, we do this and that and the other thing. We, you know, we get a sponsor. We do the steps. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got that. I get that. I'm going to do that. Yeah, I'll get to it. And so we go to this meeting over at the, you know, this men's stag, and so I'm kind of familiar with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous now. I know a lot about it. I've been to two meetings. So I go up to Bud, and Bud hands me my, you know, my first big book and tells me, read the first 164 pages, read the, you know, the doctor's opinion, read the prefaces, the forewords, all those ones with the funny little characters at the bottom, read all that, and the first 164 pages. And I said, okay, I'll do that, Bud. I said, Bud, I've been hearing a lot about this sponsor thing. Do you have a, could you be my sponsor? And Bud says, you know, I don't think I'm the right guy for that. No, I'm pretty sure I'm not the right guy. Just read the first 164 pages, keep going to meetings, and find somebody. I haven't seen Bud since that men's stag. That was almost 3.5 years ago. I'm sure Bud's still sober because he had over 20 years when I met him, and he had a program that I'm still understanding today. But, you know, somebody's told me that he was your Eskimo, and I don't know what he was, but I managed to stay in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for 1,202 days. I have service commitments. I have a sponsor who I trust with everything. He knows a lot more about me. He learned a lot more tonight. He, you know, it's an amazing program, this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was, when I moved from Santa Maria up to Grover Beach about 2.5 years ago, I stopped going to meetings down here in Santa Maria. I started going to meetings up in Arroyo Grande, and I was, you know, I considered myself a nomad. Really what I was isolating and hiding from you folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd go to meetings. I took a commitment up there. I was a secretary for a meeting, but I was still, you know, I'd go to the meeting. I'd do the secretary thing. I wouldn't talk to anybody. I didn't put my hand out, you know, I wasn't doing anything really, you know, to keep, I was sober, but I was still, you know, my hair was still on fire a little bit. So I, you know, I wasn't hearing what I needed to hear. I was telling people I didn't have a home group, that somebody had told me that your first room you go into is your home group, and I really didn't want that to be my home group. I wasn't down there. I wasn't going to meetings there. You know, I'm a nomad. I'm a, you know, I'm a lone wolf. Nobody's going to tie me down. So I started going to meetings over at the Village in Oceano. And there's guys like Dave Christie over there, who's got just celebrated 43 years of sobriety. There's another guy named Henry Torres there, who's got, I forget how many years, he just told me this morning how many years, 28 years of sobriety. There's a lot of sobriety in this room that I go to now. I have a commitment there on Friday mornings at 7 o'clock. I'm the secretary, and don't be surprised if I come up and ask you to lead a meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning. It's an honor and a privilege to lead a meeting, and thank you, Vicki, for asking me to speak here tonight. It's all I got, you know. Right now, all I got is Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a great guy to talk to when I'm not doing so good, and I have a church that I go to, so I have a higher power, and he has a name, and it ain't mine. I had my third sponsor got up at a meeting of his first birthday and apologized to everybody in the room for when he was in control of the universe. And I thought that was pretty funny. I liked it. I read the big book. I read a lot of books. I'm in a quest for knowledge. But knowledge isn't enough. You need the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Chris and I went through the big book one word at a time, talking about everything in there. He explained things to me. He told me that, you know, your drinking was just a symptom of something else. You know, liquor is but a symptom, it says in the big book. I hang on to that because my alcoholism exhibits itself in some of the craziest ways, even in sobriety. I've been going through kind of a hard time lately, and I've been talking to Chris about it, and I also, I talked to a pastor at church. I had lunch with a fellow from church. I talked to Christian men about my insanity. You know, this head of mine is always out to get my ass. I wake up every morning, and this is something else I stole. You know, a lot of the stuff that I say is not original about the program Alcoholics Anonymous, but one of the things I heard when I started going to meetings up in Arroyo Grande was, I have a disease that when I get up in the morning, it tells me I don't have a disease. You know, it's always out to get my ass, always out to beat me down, tell me I'm not good enough, so that I'll think that you're not good enough. As long as I keep, wake up in the morning and thank God for waking up, number one. Thank God I have a roof over my house. I'm fighting ants right now. And somebody at my home group tells me, well, just be glad you have a house for ants to invade. I'm grateful. You know, I'm grateful for that. That was Barney also. I have a great group of people that I go to see every morning at 7 o'clock, and that's not too early, because it was never too early for me to go and have a drink, ever. I drank every day that had a Y in it, and some days they started, and, you know, all it was just one big Y. I drank constantly. Today I don't do that. I don't have to pick up. I don't have to drink. There's one other thing I heard early in sobriety when I was new, and I'm still new, still learning this thing, still learning how to live life sober. You know, I just recently was talking to myself, you know, and then, that's when I have an idiot for a sponsor, when I'm talking to myself. And I'm thinking, God, I wish I could meet people. If I just went to the bar, if I just went down to Mongo's or over to R&D's, I'd meet people, I'd see people. Not a good idea for an alcoholic like me, because I'd be sitting in that stool, sipping that Coke. Pretty soon, I think it was a good idea to have one cocktail. And then pretty soon, the next thing I'm doing, just like it says in the big book, I'm pounding on the bar, asking for another. Pounding on the bar, acting like an asshole. Back to my old behavior, 3 years, down the toilet. And it won't ever work out for me to start drinking again. One drink, and I'm done. Like I said, I didn't go to rehab. I don't have an arrest record. High bottom drunk, but I am a garden variety drunk. Just another alcoholic. What else about me would you like to know? Probably I've heard too much already. I've been listening to, somebody gave me, I'm a secretary for the men's stag on the Mesa. A lot of good sobriety up there. That's Tuesday night at 7 to 8:30. Come on up and visit with us. We get a lot of traditional sobriety up there. Guys talk out of the big book at the village. They talk about, if it's not in the first 164 pages, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. And I agree with that. And then somebody who told me that the other day read off out of the back, and the reason he read out of there was because we were talking about sponsorship. He read out of there, some guy had 2 whole years of sobriety and he was on his 8th step and he had 5 C's. He was sponsoring guys through the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't recommend that. I did it. It didn't work. I stayed sober, but it doesn't work. You got to get a guy who's got some time, who's been through the steps with somebody who's been through the steps, who's got a lot of time. Frank is my sponsor, and Frank's sponsor was Sandy Beach. I don't know if Frank's gotten a new sponsor or not. Sandy passed away in January, I think it was, and Frank talks about in one of his pitches that Sandy had a daughter that was murdered by her husband, Sandy's son-in-law. And Frank calls him up and says, gosh, I feel bad. What can I do? Mm-hmm. And Sandy says, I already forgave him. Frank says, wow, how'd you do that? He says, well, Sandy says, I want to be more like God. That's what I want, too. I want to be more like God. I want to be able to forgive all the people, not have to have a resentment about it. I apologize to everybody that I harmed in my when I was drinking, and anybody I've harmed since I started drinking, stopped drinking. The man you see before you today is not the man that was hanging out at the Coachman Bar down on South Broadway. I've changed my life. I haven't changed my life. God has changed my life. He's put a new purpose in my life to stay sober and to help others. And I got to help my kids. I gotta help anyone that I come in contact with. I gotta help them. And I'm not gonna try and fix them, which is my MO too. I take your problem, I make it mine, hand it back to you. Don't you know what I've done for you? Aren't you gonna use my fucking solution to your problem? That's my kind of codependency there. That's the way I used to be. I try not to be like that today. I will try and fix you. My daughter used to warn people, watch out for my dad, he's a fixer. I'll try not to do that. It's all I can do to, I'll say the serenity prayer several times before I actually don't try and fix you. And it just occurred to me the other day when I was saying the serenity prayer in my home group, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, which is all of you. I can't even get the rest of the damn thing now. But the middle is me, and the wisdom to know the difference, and the difference is that I need to know the difference between trying to fix me, which needs fixing, and fixing you, which probably doesn't need my fixing, because my fixing is going to put you guys out, maybe even make you go out drinking again. If you're new or fairly new to Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome. You don't ever have to take another drink again. That's the good news. Here's the bad news. all these people are your new friends, and they're going to help you find a way to stay sober one day at a time. I made a lot of mistakes in sobriety. I did everything according to my plan for a long time. I tried to adopt his plan and his plan to stay sober one day at a time. So thank you for listening to me.
All right, let's give Tom another round of applause. All right, thank you.